Everyone has left before we call the next case. We've lost our peanut gallery.
Now that we're getting to show business.
Yeah, I know. But we'll wait till everyone's. What? Is there no water in there? We'll get you some water. Do you have enough for right now? Don't do it. He'll charge you. All right. So let's call the next case, and that is 1323-37, Fortress, Grand Corporation versus Warner Brothers Entertainment Incorporated. So, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Barangoltz.
May it please the Court, Phil Barangoltz on behalf of Appellant Fortress Grand Corporation. Fortress Grand has been selling its software called CleanSlate over the Internet since 2000. It expended millions of dollars advertising its software in order to develop a brand identity on the Internet. As a result of this brand identity that it developed, it's been able to sell millions of dollars of its CleanSlate software in a marketplace where the consumers are particularly skeptical about the security software that they use. What CleanSlate does is that it deletes the information from a user's computer in order to protect their security. In this environment, consumers are very wary of any software that potentially has indicia of being something that it otherwise may not be. In 2012, Warner Brothers released its blockbuster movie, The Dark Knight Rises. In that movie, there was featured a software called CleanSlate. That software also deleted information. With that movie, Warner Brothers had a huge marketing blitz. It flooded the market with advertising for the movie. As part of that advertising, it included two websites for the fictional CleanSlate product featured in the movie, to give it some verisimilitude.
You said fictional, right?
Yes, the software in the movie is fictional.
Well, you know, the amicus made some very interesting points about artists using product names. What about, Janis Joplin and Mercedes-Benz, or Breakfast at Tiffany's, or, we could think of a lot of examples in songs and in movies, Wile E. Coyote and Acme product, I don't know. Are all of these forbidden as well?
No.
What sets you apart?
This is a very unusual factual circumstance. In all those examples, what happened was the artist is referring to a real product, and there is no likelihood of confusion. Similarly, in Rogers v. Grimaldi, the case primarily relied on in the First Amendment side below, and by Warner Brothers, what happens there is that the artist is referring in the title or in a work to a real product in the world, and people are used to seeing that, and so they're not likely to be confused.
Well, look, it's true that movie companies sell related products like Harry Potter's wand and Batman's cape. No one really thinks that movie companies sell the more mundane products that appear in the movies. I mean, do people think that the movie industry will be selling the tea that the characters drink at breakfast or the ketchup they squeeze on their fries in the soda shop?
I think that the marketplace is moving towards that, but the real issue here is that...
You don't really, do you?
To some extent, there's much more of these product tie-ins, and in my area, this is something we see considerably more.
Well, yeah, that's for sure, but...
Really, the focus here is that after the movie came out, there's an unexplained drop in sales. Not a small amount. This is a company that sells a significant amount of its product, and all of a sudden, it has a drop in sales of over 50%. And in the investigation of that, essentially the but-for cause is that consumers who would potentially buy our product are going out onto the Internet, looking at it, and then encountering all these references to clean slate from the Batman movie. So what must they be thinking? Of course, they're thinking, well, what's going on with this Fortress clean slate? Well, you know what? I'm just not going to buy this. I'm going to click to the next thing and buy that instead. And that seems to be what happened. And our client did engage in corrective advertising in order to bring itself back to the fore in the Internet listings where it has all of its, pretty much all of its sales. And so, but that drop in sales, there was no other cause but those references that the consumers were now encountering all over the Internet, in media, and even on these websites that were for the Batman Clean Slate product.
So it's not a competing product that got in your way. It's that because of this use of this name, they shied away from your product and went to another competitor that did the same thing, I guess.
Yeah, presumably.
I don't know whether they got anything authentic from customers and said that, or people, they didn't buy for that reason, you're just implying it. But I think a lot of people probably went on the Internet looking up Clean Slate just because of the movie. They never would have looked it up for whatever purpose you have.
We have the circumstantial evidence of the actual confusion, which is our drop in sales, which otherwise has no explanation, basically on a rolling average, so how much we were selling the weeks before.
There's a better product out there. I mean, there are a lot of explanations.
Well, there are many plausible explanations, but for purposes of this appeal, that's the one that at least our circumstantial evidence suggests is the right one. And I think the court below actually ignored that whole concept of reverse confusion. Sands Taylor, this circuit's decision from a number of years ago, explains that it's also the producer's identity that's at stake.
Well, in a reverse confusion claim, customers buy the senior user's goods, thinking that they're getting the junior user's goods. And it seems to me that you are wanting us to take this one step further and say that people stop buying the junior user goods because they thought they were getting the senior users' fake goods.
It's a little bit different than that. Our argument essentially is, the first part is absolutely true. We are arguing that our potential purchasers are choosing not to buy our product because our identity has been compromised by the use of Clean Slate for this fictional product that then got lots of attention over the Internet and references and the websites that they produced.
Well, it's awfully hard to make an argument that customers would be confused between buying a real product and an imaginary one.
Well, and that's our argument isn't exactly that they're confused between that. It's that they're choosing not to buy ours because suddenly our identity is compromised. So
isn't part of the problem, though, that your identity uses a descriptive term? Your trademark is descriptive. It's a cliche. And even a descriptive trademark can give you exclusive rights within a certain context. But now you're saying we've got exclusive rights even in fictional worlds to this cliche.
No, much more narrow than that. So, yes, you're right. We have an incontestable registration, exclusive rights within the security software arena, and the trademark office found that a suggestive mark, not relevant here. What we have exclusive rights to is the ability to control our identity as against uses that are so similar that they confuse our customers.
Right. But so, let me try to come at it this way. If Warner Brothers were selling a real clean slate software, you've got a slam dunk case. How does your theory take into account, if at all, for First Amendment and other related purposes, the fact that this is fictional, that there's no real product?
Basically, our theory is that under the traditional likelihood of confusion standard, that can be taken into account by the court below. So we may have to prove something more, but we have these lost sales, which at the initial pleading stage are pretty strong evidence that there is a problem.
It sounds like your answer is that you don't take into account the fact that this is fictional.
Well, their mark travels in commerce through the movie. So in that sense, it fits squarely within the Lanham Act.
It's not a competing product.
It's not a competing product in the sense of they don't have a clean slate software. That's true.
It doesn't exist. Right.
Right. We don't argue that it does. As far as we know, they don't have one. They don't plan on one.
But you seem to be arguing that the First Amendment cannot protect any use of a mark that causes confusion. But that can't possibly be so, because First Amendment protections for artistic works have to be more robust than that and have to tolerate at least some amount of confusion in the name of protecting artistic expression. I mean, maybe there's someone out there that thinks that Andy Warhol was endorsing Campbell's soup. And I suppose it's possible that Campbell's Soup didn't like the fact that this very unusual artist, you know, was endorsing them. But whatever confusion his art might have created, no one denies that it would still be entitled to First Amendment protection.
I think there's a balance to be struck. Rogers is one way to do it, but here, where there's been actual lost sales, that balance has to be struck at a level that's beyond simply dismissing the case over an erroneous application of the confusion standard.
Okay, and obviously that invites all kinds of hold-up litigation, right?
That's the concern.
If every mention of a brand name in fiction, novels, TV, movies, online games, and so on, if every mention of a brand name invites litigation that must go to discovery, at least to summary judgment and maybe to trial, we're opening up whole new realms of trademark litigation between reality and fiction. Is that what we should be doing?
It's an unusual circumstance here.
Not necessarily. It's if we agree with you, I see whole new lines of litigation between reality and fiction.
We're not trying to increase the litigation, but for our particular client who's had these lost sales.
I understand that. Yeah. But tell me why I shouldn't be worried about those vistas.
To the extent that the likelihood of confusion standard takes that into account. This circuit just earlier this year had a vaguely similar case, Eastland Music, where it was over the movie 50-50. The plaintiff had a rap group called 50, spelled P-H-I-F-T-Y, 50, and the defendant had a movie just called 50-50, the way you would use the numbers, over the main character's ability to survive cancer. The Seventh Circuit applied the standard likelihood of confusion analysis and there found that there's simply no likelihood of confusion. No one would think those two products were related, or those two services, really. Here, where we have evidence of the actual confusion, we should be allowed to go forward. And I think it's a very high bar, actually, to have where there is admittedly a fictional product. So it's a high bar. I don't think you can just come in and willy-nilly say, well, they're the same marks and the goods are somewhat similar. And there, by the way, they weren't very similar goods, in my opinion. That said, here, this particular fictional software they had is essentially a criminal mirror image of what our client's product does. And that's what caused the real problems in the real world. I think that bar is not so low as to simply invite all this litigation. Otherwise, I think we would have seen it already. And as the the district court and the leading treatise on this area suggests there are almost no cases.
Not yet.
You want to save some time, I would think.
Yes, we saved 5 minutes
rebuttal.
For rebuttal.
No, you are into it, so.
Oh, I'll wait.
I'm Lady Bountiful, but only to a point.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Bart from Jenner and Block, and I'm representing Warner Brothers. I think that my initial comments have been taken by some of the questions that the panel has already asked. This is a request for a very radical change in trademark law. It is a change that would take litigation that recognizes the rights to protect one's mark against competing uses in the market, in the commercial marketplace, against competing goods, and completely change that so you don't need competing goods. The biggest number one issue in this case is that there are no competing products. Plaintiff's counsel admits that. On the one hand, yes, I guess you could say that the film is a product, but there's no allegation that the film competes with business computer security software.
Right, but the statute is written in terms not just of competing products, mm-hmm. but in essence in terms of confusion about, affiliation, connection, or association.
Absolutely.
And given all the product placement deals one hears about mm-hmm. as just a lay consumer,
right.
Why is that an implausible perception by movie viewers?
Well, I think that there are a couple of responses to that. The first is that the moviegoers, the market for every court that has considered the issue of the placement of a product in a film versus a real-life product that competes with that, considers the film itself to be the competing product. And that's been litigated several times, and every court that's considered that has considered the film to be the actual product. Secondly, the product placement issue, which is not found in the complaint but was really an afterthought that was added into the appellate process, is really addressing a forward confusion claim. It is addressing the placement of a product in a film. There is no placement of a product in the film. There is, to use Your Honor's expression, the use of a generic English expression in a film to describe a fictional product. It's not a situation where you have a Bud can on a table or a Mercedes-Benz parked outside. It is the use of English language to describe a product that doesn't exist. And frankly, I would say not even as a mark, but actually just to describe the product and the panel.
I wondered about that, but then you guys put up these websites, right?
Well, actually, we never did put up the websites.
Okay.
And that is, I mean, one of the problems in dealing with this at this stage of the pleadings is they can allege whatever they want to allege. These are fan websites, and Warner Brothers had nothing to do with these sites. That would come out if it was necessary to, but it's not necessary to, because this case needs to be dismissed, and the question only is on what basis is it going to be dismissed.
Well, why tell me why we should consider the First Amendment issue? Shouldn't we avoid a constitutional issue if we can decide this case just based on the statute?
You're well within your rights, Your Honor, to do so. I think that there is a reason to address it here because of the concerns that Judge Hamilton had mentioned before about this type of litigation and the chilling effect on films. There have been 4 district court decisions in this circuit applying the Rogers test, including this one, and including the Eastland one that the Seventh Circuit decided without addressing it. You see, counsel discussed the Eastland case and said, well, we decided it was decided on a likelihood of confusion basis. Not really. It was really decided on the basis that there was no allegation of a trademark violation. Just like here, there's no allegation of a trademark violation. The Seventh Circuit said no one could really believe that a film studio was putting out this rap album. It's even more extreme here. Nobody would ever believe that a film studio is putting out security software. And one of the most telling gaps in all of this is you have to look at the complaint. The complaint alleges what their alleged confusion is. What they allege is not that anyone came to them and said, where do we get that movie software? Are you affiliated with Warner Brothers or anything that would suggest reverse confusion? All they say in their complaint is there are blogs and tweets out there where people wonder whether or not the software in the Batman movie is real. That's not reverse confusion. That's just confusion in the air. That's not actionable under anybody's standard. So there are so many different ways in which this case can and should be dismissed. There aren't competing products. There is no actionable confusion. And there is the chilling effect of the First Amendment. I would respectfully request that given, or suggest, not I guess I request it as well, that the court take the opportunity, though, to join the other circuits that have adopted Rogers for that very reason. The 11th Circuit did it just last year to join the 9th Circuit and the 8th Circuit and the 7th and the 2nd, and district courts in this circuit have done it as well, and I believe are looking for guidance to address what the entire panel has suggested. How do we protect expressive works? How do we make sure that there isn't a chilling effect, that there isn't a whole series of unreasonable litigation? Well, we do it by having a test that is not an absolute immunity, as the appellant says in its papers, but is a balancing test that says only in certain limited circumstances is it appropriate for us to subject expressive works to Lanham claims. And those situations are only when it has no artistic relevance whatsoever to the work, it's a gratuitous use, or where it's explicitly misleading. Those are the two standards of the Rogers test, and they make eminent sense. They're saying there should be, because the First Amendment is a bedrock principle of our society, there should be firm protection of First Amendment rights unless somebody's abusing those rights. It's not an absolute test. If somebody is just gratuitously glomming on, it has no artistic meaning, then yes, there could be a claim. That's not the claim here. And just to drive the point home, the district court in Rogers did apply an absolute immunity, and the Second Circuit said, no, we're not going that far. We're not taking the other extreme, which is, one of the other extremes is there any other way of expressing the same idea without using those words? They said, no, we're not going to put that sort of restriction on the creators of expressive works, but we're also not going to give you an immunity. We're going to have a balancing test that protects the First Amendment and yet prevents abuse. And other circuits that have considered it, and all of the circuits that have considered it directly, have adopted it. None have rejected it. None have rejected it in this district, in the districts of this circuit as well. And I think there's a real prophylactic policy reason to take that extra step, particularly in light of Eastland, which was a strong statement earlier this year that you can dismiss cases where there is no allegation of a trademark injury at the pleading stage, and that's sufficient, granted, to dismiss this case and to affirm the decision below. But I think this is the perfect opportunity for this court to join the other circuits and say, we're going to adopt a defined standard which will protect the First Amendment values and limit claims against them to abuse of the First Amendment rights.
So, Mr. Burt, I was trying to imagine a gratuitous, unprotected use.
Mm-hmm.
This is fanciful, but let me try this out on you and see if you would agree. And I don't think Fiat makes motorcycles.
I think it does.
You think it does? Oh, then this doesn't work at all. Okay.
Well, take Subaru then.
Well, the problem is that Subaru doesn't have a nice acronym for Fix It Again, Tony,
which
was the old
we'll assume they don't make
it. They don't make motorcycles, and somebody puts an imaginary Fiat motorcycle into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And brings out some of the, frankly, disparaging kinds of comments that at least used to be associated with that brand.
Mm-hmm.
And then suppose maybe it's at least funded or urged by a competitor, BMW or something, with its motorcycles. Is that the kind of thing we would have to worry about under the Rogers test?
Well, I think it would come...
I stand corrected.
The problem with immediate access to all of the information in the world.
Judge Rovner is on top of this. I'll have to think of something else. So.
Debatably, it would come closer to the line. I don't even think that that would do it, Your Honor. I think that there is an entitlement to bring the real world into expressive works. For example, Warner Brothers won a case last year that I'm familiar with, which where there was
it was you, wasn't it?
Where Louis Vuitton sued them over the movie The Hangover 2. Because there were a couple of bags that were used in an airport scene, and Zach Galifianakis, I always mispronounce his name, forgive me, says, puts one of them on the seat, and another character starts moving the bags away. He said, watch that, that's a Louis Vuitton. That plays a role in the movie. It gives a certain verisimilitude to the movie. It gives you a real-life connection. That's one of the reasons for the First Amendment right. When you're creating an expressive work, one of the things you're trying to do is to make the public connect to certain elements that they're familiar with. Let me just, because I know that my time's going to run up quickly, and I think I've given you the broad parameters of why there are so many different reasons for affirming the decision below. But one of the things that I think that we need to, or that should be underscored here, is the different nature of the markets here. One of the underlying things that they do here is they try to blur the lines. They refer to WB's Warner Brothers software, Warner Brothers products. Of course, they don't exist. There is no software. There are no products. The attempts to analogize these, as Judge Rovner said, to Harry Potter wands or whatever, is fanciful. There has never been a case which has made reference to sophisticated business software. So then, who is their product marketed to? According to their own complaint, which they've tried very hard to run away from on the appeal, the market for this is business computer networks. This is not a product that's available to the general. It may be available. It's not marketed to the general public. This is marketed to corporations that have public terminals and other computers that have multiple users. What they want to do is to make sure that if the Admiral's Club at O'Hare has a computer terminal and I go onto it, this software erases all references to me so that the next user doesn't have access to my information. So the people that are buying this software are sophisticated IT personnel of major corporations. This is not somebody sitting in his or her living room and deciding, do I need this for my personal computer? This is sophisticated business software. The notion that those people who are making buying decisions for these corporations are confused by a fictional product in a movie about Gotham City and Batman and Catwoman, it goes beyond fanciful. And so I think that dealing with this on any realistic level, there are no competing products. There is no allegation of confusion. The only thing that there is the ipsy-dixit of, I say there's a loss of sales, therefore I'm entitled to bring a lawsuit that gets past
that.
What
if the next case doesn't involve all these sophisticated, people? Does it matter?
No, it doesn't. But that's just underscores why this particular case is even more ripe for dismissal and affirmance. But it doesn't need to rise to that sort of a level. So I think that for all of those different reasons and the difference in the marketplace, the fact that product placement doesn't matter, and in fact, they focus so much on reverse confusion. Let me just make one other point. It's not a matter that people don't realize that this is a reverse confusion case, although in their complaint they allege both forward and reverse confusion. The problem is that reverse confusion cases require two real products. There's never been a reverse confusion case anywhere that has allowed the case to go forward without two real products in the marketplace. And we've now briefed this through four levels of briefing, and plaintiff has not been able to identify any such cases because there are no such cases. There is no, the product placement doesn't matter, the reverse confusion doesn't matter, and simply getting up and alleging, I lost sales, which is really what all this case comes down to. The case comes down to, yes, I concede it's a fictional product, yes, I can see that they're different markets, but I lost sales. That's not a sufficient basis for a trademark claim, and no case ever said that it was. if you, well, I'm not going to get into product analysis. There just is no legal support for it. And I'll just leave the panel with the thought that this is a perfect opportunity for the panel and the circuit to join its sister circuits and to adopt a standard that properly protects First Amendment protection. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time? Three.
I'd just like to address a couple of points. One, adopting Rogers v. Grimaldi in a reverse confusion context amounts to an absolute immunity. Rogers v. Grimaldi is very specific in talking about the explicitly misleading prong. Well, if you're not referring to the product, which is the case in reverse confusion, then there's no possibility for it to ever be explicitly misleading. So this case is particularly inappropriate for adopting that particular precedent, because we don't contend that they're referring to our product. They're not, and presumably they didn't intend to. What we contend is that by virtue of their use of Clean Slate as a mark for an admittedly fictional product, that confused our actual customers.
So I'm wrong if I think that in a reverse confusion claim, customers buy goods thinking they're getting someone else's goods.
It's one way in which reverse confusion happens.
Well, but you just said that's not the way it happens.
So reverse confusion is that the senior user is overwhelmed by the junior user. So here, if they had a real Clean Slate software, essentially because of their market power, we wouldn't be able to sell ours. People would think ours comes from them. And that is, since they're never referring, in reverse confusion, they're never referring to the senior user. That's not the point of reverse confusion. They're just coming up with a mark. The Gatorade is Thirstate example, and this circuit is the primary example. They didn't know about the Thirstate product by the senior user, and they weren't intending to. If we adopt Rogers v. Grimaldi and then say that it has to be explicitly misleading, the junior user's use, that would never follow, because they're not referring to the senior user's product at all. It just isn't what reverse confusion is about. I'm almost out of time. The only other thing I wanted to address there is that our potential customers run the whole gamut. They're sophisticated customers. There are people with home networks. You could download it yourself and use it to wipe your computer clean. The point is that all of these people are susceptible to the same type of confusion. They're going out on the Internet, they're seeing our product, and they're seeing references to another Clean Slate. And so once they do that, they're saying, well, I don't know what these guys are selling. I don't care anymore. They move on. It's one click, and it's done. And so this is particularly a problem for our marketplace, where we only sell through the Internet. Our client only uses the Internet as a marketing tool, and that's the primary method that our consumers encounter our mark. And now our commercial identity, as discussed in Sands, Taylor, and Rose, has been, at least for a time period before the corrective advertising, it was usurped. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Did you want to finish your thought? I heard you say and.
I think it would be more of the same. It's our market identity that's been taken by this fictional use.
Thank you very much to both parties, and the case will be taken under advisement.